Enterprise computing seems to be cycling back toward decentralization. There were mainframes in the 60s and 70s that started it off. The PC revolution decentralized things in the 80s and 90s. Then the cloud centralized things again over the past decade or so. But this era seems to be giving way to decentralization once again. The company Cyxtera Technologies is an example of this dispersal. It owns data centers in multiple geographies and offers co-location, cybersecurity, software platform services, and infrastructure. We spoke with Zach Hilliard, the Senior Director of Cyber Liability Engineering, and the first thing we asked him is, today, in 2019, what is a data center?
Right now, it's an interesting because it's like a transforming location. Historically, a data center had been, you know, your hub and spoke. You know, one of them is the master, and then everyone else is kind of on the edge with ancillary offices. Now we're seeing that, you know, this is just a point of presence. Master is nowhere anymore. You may have workloads shifted in one location or another. The other big thing that we see happening a lot is people more and more adopting metros. So that's another one of our kind of bread and butter suites is that I can put Nutanix HA for you, not just at a block level, but at a geographic level. So if you go into like my New Jersey market, for example, there's five data centers that are fiber interconnected. And one could be miles away, but still on the other end of a piece of fiber. So it feels like it's in your cage, but yet now you have geographic redundance. So we're seeing that the data center is now just one step in the solution. A lot of people, I would say in the like 2007 and on, kind of started seeing AWS become like the cloud, and they become very myopic, and they're like, oh, we're going to do everything in the cloud, everything in the cloud. And we get in a situation that like Lyft and Uber are facing where we're not hugely profitable. We're spending $3 million a month or $8 million a month in the cloud, and we have no strategy to get out because I have no partner to put S3 or database as a service in my data center. But granted, I could cut my cost if I could shift over there, but I can't because where we're at. So now we see more and more people like Nutanix show up. They're like, hey, I have 70% of the cloud features that you will want that would help you shift out, and I can do your TCO by 41% if you come in. And I pull that 41% number from our own internal. So we use one of our other businesses that came up underneath Cyxtera was a predominant user of AWS. And I went to them and started looking at what they had, and I made them a customer of CXD and immediately cut my bill by 41% with zero optimization, just really dealing with like how storage behaves in somewhere like the cloud. And all of this kind of segues back into, you know, the data centers are becoming popular again. You know, a lot of people are moving into colo. They just need to get solutions that feel cloud-like, but need to be invisible. And so that's where, you know, for us, we really see Nutanix or HCI in general as a strong competitor in there because your developers can still have that velocity that they're looking for. I can still do push-button database as a service or use Calm for self-provisioning or things like that. But my, you know, finance guys and gals and compliance guys and gals are extra happy because everything's in a data center behind latch and key and all my compliance requirements. So that's kind of where I see the market shifting.
You mentioned Uber in another context, but let me ask you this. What about the idea of Uber for data centers?
We're like the early Uber for data center because, you know, in the grand scheme, you could buy anything for like a month or a year at a time, and it's just it's a one-time kind of CapEx cost. I'm not going to have this long-going OpEx that we're going to have to worry about. And we start seeing that, and that's where the hybrid cloud really shows up the most is that they're saying, well, how do I burst this seasonal workload into somewhere, whatever that means, and bring it back and not, you know, get a three-year contract out of the deal. Now, granted, do I believe we're going to do this every year for 3 years? Sure. But when you're, you know, a startup or you're a marketing team and you're really running it on your own, you know, IT is like, hey, you know, you have your own, you know, your own micro IT segment. They're like, how are we going to do this? We can't sign up for, you know, 3 years in a data center. So that's where we see kind of that Uber Lyft, you know, the lift and shift of work. For me, you know, again, I'm a container guy by desires. So we look at Kubernetes is now enabling everyone to be able to do more lift and shift style behavior. Because if it runs on Kubernetes on Carbon, chances are with minimal effort, we will be able to get it to run on GKE or AKS or any one of the other Kubernetes as a service. And more, we're actually seeing it so they can like automatically shift. We have what we would call like node pool, and I can say this nodes are AWS, these nodes are Azure, and you know, we can say, well, spot pricing is cheaper in AWS right now, so we're going to do batch processing over there at the moment. I still have to have somewhere to do that from, though. You still have to have a home base, you know, and that's where not everything is portable, where there are people today that get away with like no car. You know, they're like, I don't think you can get away with no data center or no tenancy in a cloud somewhere, but you can get away with being hypermobile inside of those and preventing some of the, a little bit of that vendor lock-in that we see.
So let me ask this next question as kind of a two-part question, and I'll do the first part like this. The future of anything almost demands that something's going to go away.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you look at the future of data centers, what do you see going away?
Good question. I see what I would call like dedicated server farms becoming more and more diminished. I think more and more as we see customers shifting into microservice-oriented architectures are really, I mean, it's 2019 and we're still seeing customers having a hard time struggling on full-on VMware adoption or VM adoption, in case may be. And what I really see is that, you know, we don't see monolithic racks of all the same gear that do all the same action. You know, we've started moving to it's a pile of CPU and memory, and then we allow, you know, the business or IT to divvy this up and you know, ditch the siloed IT behavior. Now, you know, I provision a VM, it could be on that machine, it could be on this machine, it's wherever we have it. And a lot of time that's fighting some of the prior, well, you know, this is my fiefdom, that's your fiefdom. If I have excessive memory, that's, you know, historically, I have no way to give it to you, quote unquote. But when we move into the kind of the shared world, everyone's less segmented from a hardware standpoint. You know, we are a better way to share, and you know, SDN and things like that have come in and allowed us to extend that way.
And then the other part of the question is, what's going to get created? So, you know, there are all sorts of ways compute will be used that no one expects. So I'm not even sure what kind of example to give, whatever it might be. It's a weird question to ask without a lot of context, but what needs to be created?
I think one of the things that I see regularly, and I will always typically bring it back to containers because that is my forte. New technologies are talked about with great fervor. We see lots of momentum behind them, and the wave is a little way out, but it's not a tiny wave, unfortunately. It's like a 4-foot tall wave, and by the time the 4-foot tall wave hits you, there's like a 12-foot just coming behind that. And I use an example like, you know, Kubernetes, where if you go back 4 or 5 years ago, everyone was like, yeah, look at this cool thing Google's making, and it's awesome, and everyone was trying to get their first toes in it. But if you wanted to use it back then, you were pretty much on your own. So what I look for is now vendors showing up to say, hey, we'll sit down and kind of fill in some of these gaps where these, you know, the 2-foot wave is now maybe like a 6-inch wave. You're still going to have some efforts to deal with. There's still going to be challenges, but getting that solution to you is not the very first challenge. You know, we have a slide in the Kubernetes 101 talk that we do that, you know, Kubernetes is difficult or hard, and it shows kind of a breakdown of how often people kind of, which piece of the hill do people die on? And a lot of times it's adoption. They're just trying to like, or even get it in there. So I come from Red Hat in prior days doing OpenShift, and a lot of times I show up and they've had the gear for, or the solution for 6 months, and they just haven't done anything with it because we're just not there yet. We don't know. And even with Red Hat being kind of the far right-hand side where it's a really engineered solution with all this extra stuff, they're just like, there's too much to eat here. So for my goal, you know, what I see the hole is someone kind of putting in a generic, nice, clean, not overly complicated solution, not trying to add your flavor to it, just trying to let it be kind of, let the product itself shine through. Just our magic is that we automated the install or have a manageability is better. And, you know, you can swap out Kubernetes to Kafka. You know, 5 years ago, Kafka was the new hotness. Or, you know, you can flip it out to Mesosphere or Docker Swarm. I mean, any one of these falls into the same boat that it was like the fervor is really high and the desire to do it is really high. But then when it gets back to the IT guys and gals, they already have enough challenges day to day that now we're asking them to kind of go read this, like, you know, small encyclopedia of effort, digest it all, and then make what one would classify good decisions. And then, you know, that second piece, they're like, well, why did you make this choice? And I'm like, well, there was so much information that I could only consume so much, and we made a choice and we went with it. And those guys kind of cause these little holes where, you know, S3 bucket is exposed to the internet forever. don't worry, the guy or gal that did that didn't mean to. You know, they weren't being malicious in that. There's just so much going on. They don't understand implications. So we need a vendor or a guiding hand. And we tend to get those through things like, you know, Carbon or Files, where, you know, it'll show us there is a way to do this. You have everything you need. It's just, you know, you needed some opinions behind it and some assistance. That way you can really concentrate on actually doing the work, not getting to the point you can do the work.
You know, in listening to you, it would be very easy to think that you started off as, you know, a six-year-old with a computer that you were pulling apart or putting together or writing code or something like that. And in talking to you before the interview, realized that everyone's got their own story about what got them into it. What got you into it?
Oh, that's an interesting path. So, like, I can tell because it's not nice to ask, evidently. But I'm 33, so I'm a kind of young dude. And I come by way of being a diesel mechanic. So, you know, I started early in life as, like, I like cars. I'm a car guy. And I did not listen to my mom. And she chose to tell me, like, don't make your hobby your job. So I did that, and that was not great. And I started out at, like, a data center company. And my dad did Linux or Unix, HPUCs prior. So I had a little bit of that experience. And I was like, you know what? This is they have air conditioning, and it's generally, typically, a fairly clean job. My hands don't come back, like, gashed in and covered in mud. Typically, that has happened, though. And so, you know, I started out in humble beginnings of working midnight to 10 a.m. with a really angry dude with me. And he taught me the chops of, you know, you're not going to just ask me. You're going to do a little troubleshooting and dig around. And that was with a company called The Planet. And I, you know, I dug in. I got into RHCE, and I did my Red Hat stuff and all of that jazz. And going down that path, I really started on operations. So I was, you know, the guy or girl you call and say, hey, my server's crashed or whatever, and we go through and figure out what's going on, and maybe you just messed up FS tab and I just have to fix it and everything's good. As that went, more and more I found myself displeased with how my organizations ran operations, and I went from a tier one engineer to a dedicated customer. So I was working for a bank, making sure that their stuff is running. Went to problem management, and that's when I really started complaining. I was like, hey, my tier one group's not great. They're not, like, killing the tickets the way I think we should. I could. And they gave me an opportunity to take that over, and that was kind of that first jump into managing a team. And quickly I realized, well, hey, I'm like, you know, we have an affectionate term for ourselves of neckbeards. You know, I'm the nerd, but I also have some people skills, and I kind of understand, like, how to talk to management and tell them, like, what this bird is different and why. And we went through that, and I continued to iterate that on that, and it gave me an opportunity inside of Verizon to jump over to a quasi-development and configuration management team. So we were writing a lot of stuff with, like, Salt Stack, and using a lot of, you know, VMware and hypervisor and all this, but we're really dealing with compliance and patching and, you know, information gathering, things of this nature. And that kind of gave me that taste into development. And as a last big hoorah at Verizon, I moved over to the enterprise cloud with them. And that was probably 2 years before that IBM purchase, so we were looking to modernize it. And they gave me that opportunity to do development. So through my operations days, I'd always written Python and Bash and Perl to just make my life easier. You know, I need to check 100 machines, what version XYZ is. I'm not going to do that by hand. I'm going to write some expect library or expect script to go do it. So when I went over here, they're like, okay, he writes Python and he knows all this stuff. Let's help with automating some operations stuff. And the very first thing that they asked for was configuration management as a service. And where that segues is Kubernetes. I had been using Salt Stack. I knew one of the huge detriments to Salt Stack, and it's by design, is that it is not a multi-tenant system. Salt Stack isn't designed to have, you know, things protected from one another. You know, you might see all these messages. So our first answer is, wouldn't it be nice to be able to spin up, like, a Salt Stack master pair on demand, just as it goes? And so our first, you know, idea was, oh, I'll just, you know, I'll code it all myself. And this is where we kind of go back to the beginning, where there's no, like, center for accepted execution ideas. And one of my other engineers that was, you know, ex-employee but now a peer, was like, hey, I want to, like, this Kubernetes thing or something is looking really cool. Like, maybe we should play with it. And let me tell you, it was a lot of trial by fire. But sitting in on that and seeing where it started in, like, the 0.3 and 4 days, and then where it's come to today, and by way of also spending a little bit of time at Red Hat, you know, I kind of got the idea of how how I did it in what I would call like the caveman era, how Red Hat does it, which, you know, Red Hat has a very strong opinion on how they want to put it together. And I went through and installed that at a bunch of customers, and I had very similar conversations to like we're having here with their engineering staff, because, you know, they're like, how do we solve X? Well, this can't do Y, or, you know, whatever, and working through that. So I got way more experience than probably the average bear through just setting it up and installing it for Red Hat. And even that wasn't a super long stint. I mean, in 6.5 months, I think I still had like 9 or 10 customers, and those are all very long engagements. And if you do 9 or 10 installs, including the like the integrations, you're probably a little more versed than the average person. And that's where Cyxtera really showed up. They knew where they were going. They had already selected Kubernetes. So it wasn't like that, you know, I showed up and this became a benevolent idea. But their first answer was like, hey, we're the dev team and we really want to use Kubernetes. We're already doing it today and we're not doing it good. How do we get better? And so, you know, that's where the segue into like pushing that next tier, what we'd consider now that Kubernetes is enterprise class. I'm using air quotes, you know, they classify it as enterprise. It's still very new. The adoption is not where we would air quote want it, but it is driving towards that. So, you know, I hopped in with them and have added another feather to the hat of like the 10th company that we've seen the challenges. You know, we're working through them. I'm actually lucky because we talked earlier that I have 6 different companies underneath me and they're all very different. And part of our goal is to driving them towards, if it can be containerized, we should containerize it because we have this vast ecosystem that exists, you know, to your left. I would like you to shift all your workloads to the left. And in order to do that, we've had to create a flow that makes sense to them. So, you know, GitLab can deploy directly to Kubernetes. I don't really need you to know Kubernetes. I need you to write code in a nice, proficient way. During my talk, we talked about, like, I need you to be able to shut down cleanly. I need you to understand some of these concepts that come from Kubernetes, but really let me worry about the Lego. You just worry about putting all the Legos together. And that's kind of how we got where we are today.
So, Zach, if there's one thing that you wished everyone knew about tech, from where you sit, the things that you have to deal with, what would that be?
And this is going to seem counterintuitive. Don't jump on the new shiny. You know, we see a lot of times, and I'm guilty of it, you know, I hark that in 2004 I was doing Kubernetes. That wasn't the smartest thing to do because, if you know, I came back from a risk analysis point of view. You're running something that doesn't even have a 1 in its version number in Google for really strongly warns you that you should not be running this in production. We do, and we pay a lot of PhDs. Because ultimately, when there's not a lot of information out there to consume and there's no way to get that to people, you know, one operations guy or gal makes a choice that now a business needs to live with. So kind of unifying where we come from in a technology selection. I think CNCF is helping that, the Cloud Native Compute Foundation, where I know I can go there and look for an answer. If they have an answer for it, I know it's going to exist, the documentation exists, or at least they're upfront and say, it's an incubator. And if I, you know, it says it's an incubator, I'm acutely aware of what incubator means. It means probably not production yet. Whereas a lot of time, you know, if you just scroll across GitHub, you might find a really cool tool and you really want to use it, but it's nowhere near production ready. And, you know, I guess that's a little narrow, but these are the problems that I try to face is that, you know, I see a developer, like my favorite story for this is that, you know, I had a security guy reading or looking through CI/CD logs and they saw a message that says hacked by the Chinese. And like, why are everything's going off and everyone's crazy? And I was like, no, time out. Let me show you. It's on GitHub. And it was really a Node.js library that protected if someone was idling. But the guy's name was hacked by the Chinese. Since I don't have a great way for this information or like technology to come from an authoritative source, and it's this guy's GitHub page, you know, security ran around all crazy. We finally figured it out, and I'm like, oh, bro, it's just a Node.js thing. Don't worry. And they're like, oh, how did you find out? And I'm like, well, I Googled it. And surprisingly, you're not the first person to have ever had this red flag raised. So, you know, we go down those routes, and there's no like blessed location for you to get, you know, rock solid open source things. So, you know, maybe putting all that together and saying, like, here's NPM, but certified, because then I can pay nerds to look at the code.
Zach, thanks for talking to us today.
All right, thank you all.
Zach Hilliard is the Senior Director of Cyber Liability Engineering for Cyxtera Technologies.